Future-proof extra from News Talk.
Now, when we're abroad but we don't know the language, there are some universal gestures we can employ in order to get our message across, some more civil than others. But what about languages or sounds? Can they be universally recognized across borders and cultures? Well, Alexandra Cvek is a doctoral researcher from the Leibniz Center General Linguistics in Berlin. She joins me now. Welcome to the program, Alexandra. You are a researcher in this area of language and spoken communication. Why are you interested in that?
Well, I have to say I have always been interested in sounds. So I always wanted to work in the area of phonetics from the earliest times in my linguistic studies. And I think I was just drawn to languages in general. I remember asking my mom, always hearing a language in television, "Mom, what is this language?" And she was perplexed to answer. So I think I was just drawn to the sounds of languages. And by accident, actually, I ended up working on the on iconicity in language in Berlin.
What is iconicity?
So iconicity is the resemblance between form and meaning. And there are certain words in language that depict this, the thing that they mean. For example, flick-flack or swish, right? They sound like what they are depicting, right? This, it's not so much about the dictionary kind of meaning, but the feeling that is transported through sound.
So not just onomatopoeia though, right? The idea that a word, if you hear it, you get a sense of what it might be, even though it may not sound like the noise that something makes, like buzz, for example.
Exactly. So onomatopoeia is one of this very common correspondences where we can map the sound to the object that is making the sound. But this goes well beyond onomatopoeia, right? So we can look into other dimensions like flick, maybe, or yeah, swish and flick. It's more about the movement than it is about the sound exactly. And English is not the perfect example for this. There are languages that have many more of these words that correspond to different sensory dimensions, like movement or even smells or something like that. But we can also not only focus on the surface of the words, but go deeper into what language is. For example, the prosody, so the intonation, or single sounds of speech, and look for these iconic kind of form-meaning correspondences.
So one of the things you were trying to understand is how things get their name in a way, and whether or not there are certain sounds that are sort of understandable, have a meaning that is almost cross-cultural. Can you tell me a little bit about your research where you try to explore this?
Well, colleagues of mine conducted a research project where they asked people to communicate 30 different meanings by non-linguistic means. So without using language, any language. For example, for sleep, you can imagine the easiest way to communicate sleep without language would be something like that. Or eating. You know, we make sounds when we eat, like, right? This is kind of symbolic for eating. But they also tested very different meanings like dull or sharp or child or cooking, right? And also some very, very hard, we may think that they would be hard to depict, like this and that, right? How do you want to express that without saying this or that? So they asked people to record themselves making noises for these meanings. And then they asked American native speakers to recognize the meanings back. And they
So you're saying that you would give them a word and they weren't allowed to use language or make the noise of that thing specifically. And then they recorded that, sent it to someone else, and that person had to guess without language what the meaning of the word was?
Well, the people recorded their sounds for 30 different meanings. Some of them were animals, people, properties, etc. And then they sent it back to their experimenters. And the experimenters, my colleagues, they conducted a research project where they asked American native speakers to recognize those meanings. And they gave them 6 alternatives. Only one was correct, right? And they could see that they recognized those meanings very well. But then they thought, well, all of these people involved in the project spoke English. Better or worse, some were native speakers, some were not, but they still had this common culture. So what we wanted to do is to take a step back from the English culture and look for within communities that speak very different languages, like Farsi or Japanese or Zulu, right? Some people who don't have any contact with Western culture. And we also saw that they can comprehend those vocalizations. So this was an astounding finding.
So can you give me an example? Do you remember some of these sounds that people made up to denote the meaning of a word? And if you can, I'd like to, could you give me like a multiple choice? Could we do like a mini version of your research now? Could you give me like six words and I have to guess which one? Can we try that?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so so do I first make the vocalization
and then give you? Okay. I think that's a good idea.
So let's do. And as alternatives, you have deer, many, men, fire, water, and snake.
I guess I would say water.
Water. Well, why doesn't it pan out? No, it was fire, actually,
I would also would have thought fire. Fire or water, I guess, because it was going round about so much, I thought maybe it was like a babbling brook, but I suppose. But I can totally see why fire also works.
But
this is science in the making, right? Science isn't always perfect.
So, exactly. We didn't have ceiling effects, right?
Exactly. We can blame the quality of the noise. So that's really interesting that people could understand it for something like that. You can understand how fire and water would work, but for this and that, I presume the accuracy dropped off a cliff. Or how good were people from different cultures understanding what these sounds were when it's something so abstract as this or that?
Well, I see in the recordings that people submitted, they used a contrasting strategy. So this would be hmm, and that would be hmm. This is near and that is far, right? So they could either go for the contrast in the length, right? Also in the height, right? I can't disentangle the pitch also, so I do like it drops down, right?
So in
the contrast it works, right? But people only heard one of these vocalizations at one trial, and in fact you were true that the accuracy dropped, and that was actually the worst recognized word at roughly, I'm looking at the plot here, so it's roughly 28-30% of accuracy, but still the chance level was at 16.7. So it was still above the chance level because of the 6 alternatives.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, for this, people were way better. So it was like 50%. I don't know why.
That's exactly the weird thing is, right? And you're obviously not originally an English speaker. What's your native tongue originally?
I'm a Polish native speaker.
Polish, yeah. So obviously you have excellent English, but this is exactly the sound I would have made for this. Would have been a very short hmm. And now the question I have for you is, how do you remove the bias of the fact that English is such a pervasive language? If the original noisemakers, we'll call them, if they're English speakers, that, you know, no matter what language or culture you're in, you've heard a lot of English in your lifetime if you're an adult.
Well, this actually, we asked people whether they spoke English. When we were analyzing the data, we thought, well, we could have asked them on which level they spoke English, right? Not only which languages, which foreign languages they spoke, but actually we saw that there were very few people who didn't speak English at all, right? From among almost 1,000 that were maybe 10%. right? So as you say, English or this Western culture, not English, Western culture is everywhere. Like you see Coca-Cola, even in the Amazonas. So people know that. And we actually think this might affect the comprehension, right? But even if we look at people who didn't speak English at all, reported they wouldn't speak any English or know any English, we see these effects, right? So we see that people can comprehend. And even we tested some populations in another setting, because I told you about the online experiment. We also had a field experiment with people who possibly don't read or write. There we didn't use 6 alternatives. We rather used pictures that represented the concepts.
Yeah.
And so we had speakers there who don't really have contact with the Western culture. Of course, they have cell phones, but they cannot always charge them, only if they have some diesel. And then they put on loud music. As the colleagues who conducted studies there, they just gave us a little impression of what it was like to live among these people. And they don't really have this contact, right? And we see these effects there as well.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to see if you were to take Chinese group to create their own sounds, how similar they would be to the English sounds that are made up. But also if you saw the same reciprocity, because there are not many native Mandarin speakers in the general population of English speakers proportionally, I suppose. So that'd be really, really interesting to see. But I suppose one of the things that this might help you to do is understand how words got their names, because etymology of words, it's a fascinating subject, but it can only go so far, right? Because once you go beyond written texts and spoken culture, in Ireland, we have a very good prehistoric oral history. But once you go beyond that, why you would call something land or rock or river is impossible, because you come to the end of the line of our memory, right? So is that something that you're trying to explore?
Well, we are basically trying to see what is the potential of vocal communication to ground meaning. We know that gestures, when we show something, or even point at something and say, cup, right? I show you a cup, this is a cup. Or I can trace it and say, this now we will call a shield. Agree with you somehow. Have this convention. Start this convention by using gestures. And this has been a very big thought in the evolution of language, that gestures have the capacity to ground symbols, conventional symbols that we then use to communicate. But vocal communication, not so much. It has been said that it is arbitrary.
Yeah.
We have the convention. Some philosophers in the 16th, 1700s, they said God gave us the language ready as it was. It's completely arbitrary. And this thought stuck. And people have been saying, words are arbitrary. Hockett, in the 1960s, he said, there is nothing canine about the word dog. Microorganism is a big word for something small, right? So it's not iconic. There is no form meaning resemblance. And speech is arbitrary. But what we are showing here is that speech is not arbitrary. It has this iconic potential to ground meaning. And of course, when we start using it, when we start using this for sleeping, at some point, we kind of find something that is more economical for our throat, because, you know, it hurts when you do this sound all the time. And the symbol shifts from this more iconic form to a symbolic form, right? Something that we may see as more arbitrary, more conventional. But what we are showing is that the origin might have also been vocal, not only gestural, because vocalizations that we use can be comprehended.
Yeah, I suppose that would be supported if you look at the earliest texts of written language. You understood how those earliest texts were vocalized, and then compare them across the world and see if there are patterns that might be something to explore.
But, you know, this text, I think I don't remember now, but I think the earliest texts, no, I don't want to say this because then other scientists will tell me I'm totally wrong, but say the earliest texts are 6,000 years old or 10,000 years old, but speech is, or our communication is way, way older.
Yeah.
Right.
So is it something we'll never know?
Yeah, I mean, maybe we never know. We have no time machine, at least until then. But we can think or suppose that the multimodal communication with vocalizations and gestures have been there in the beginnings and is there with us as well. You see how much I gesture,
Well, really interesting hearing about your research, Alexander Cvek, from the Leibniz Center General Linguistics in Berlin. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, Jonathan.